From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, John Ridley. He got his start as a stand-up comic, then wrote for The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Martin. Now he's writing novels and screenplays that are humorous send-ups of film noir. Oliver Stone adapted Ridley's novel Stray Dogs into the film U-Turn. Now Ridley has a new novel about an ex-wannabe screenwriter. We'll also talk with Stanley Tucci about writing, directing, and starring in the new film farce The Imposters. It's Tucci's follow-up to Big Night. Lord Schwartz reviews a CD of film music composed by Shostakovich. And Milo Miles reviews the new expanded version of the garage band anthology Nuggets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says the violence in the Yugoslav province of Kosovo could spill over into neighboring countries. He told world financial officials in Washington today, Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic is to blame for the increased violence.
President Milosevic is primarily responsible for this crisis. The United Nations has made clear the steps we must take to end it. Declare an immediate ceasefire. Withdraw Serb security forces. Give humanitarian relief groups full and immediate access to Kosovo. Begin real negotiations with the Kosovar Albanians to find a peaceful and permanent solution to their rightful demand for autonomy.
The president warns that NATO is prepared to act militarily to stop the Kosovo violence if Milosevic won't. U.S. peace envoy Richard Holbrooke says Yugoslavia has not met terms dictated by the United Nations to prevent NATO military intervention. Holbrooke's comments follow his meetings with diplomats in Kosovo and with Yugoslav's president. The White House says it is disappointed but not surprised with last night's vote by the House Judiciary Committee. Lawmakers voted along party lines to proceed with an open-ended investigation of President Clinton. White House spokesman Joe Lockhart says the vote was the culmination of a Republican strategy. The White House maintains while the president has erred, he has not committed impeachable offenses. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says there is still much work to do to reach an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. Albright is visiting Israel and the Palestinian territories today, ahead of a planned Mideast summit in Washington this month. From Jerusalem, NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Negotiators are working against a deadline of next May, when the current Oslo peace accord expires. After a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Secretary Albright said, "Time is not on our side." The difficulty of Albright's mission was clear from its start. After talks with her, Netanyahu had scheduled a special ministerial meeting to speed up the building of new homes for Jewish settlers in the West Bank. Both the U.S. and Palestinians have demanded the halt of such settlements pending a peace deal. The main goal of Albright's two-day visit is to secure a further Israeli withdrawal from 13% of the West Bank. In return, Israel wants stricter controls on Muslim militants in Palestinian-ruled areas. I'm Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Authorities in Southern California say about 1,100 people have been allowed to return home to the town of Banning. Fire crews are battling a wildfire about 30 miles east of Los Angeles that has claimed two lives. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 81 points at 7,807. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, U.S. markets at midday are following Europe and Asia higher, while investors hope for more rate cutting from the Federal Reserve Board. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Stocks are in rally mode today, at least in part over the news from some big U.S. companies that, while bad, third-quarter earnings numbers are not as bad as many had expected. Semiconductor maker Motorola has weighed in with lower-than-expected losses for its latest quarter. There's also a growing feeling among investors that the powerful Federal Reserve Board is likely to announce another interest rate cut, possibly sooner rather than later, in an effort to keep the economy from sliding into recession. Meanwhile, General Motors, the world's biggest automobile maker, announced a major restructuring today. GM says it will combine its domestic and international operations. Walmart, the country's biggest retailer, says it will open, remodel, or relocate more than 400 stores next year. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Treasury Department has compiled a report showing the global economic crisis, which has forced up the U.S. trade deficit, has also touched every state in the Union. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin says the overseas crisis directly affects the livelihood of American farmers, workers, and businesses. California, which accounts for a fourth of all shipments to Asia, saw sales to the region fall by 11% in a year's time. Delaware lost 20% of its exports to that region. Wyoming has seen Asia sales drop 63%. The White House prepared the report in an effort to pressure lawmakers to support more funding for the International Monetary Fund. Two internet companies are joining forces. Lyco says it's purchasing Wire Digital for $83 million in stock. Wire Digital offers internet-based search engines. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Ridley, used to be a stand-up comic. Then he wrote for such sitcoms as The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Martin, and The John Larroquette Show. Now he's becoming known for his novels and movies. He wrote and directed the film Cold Around the Heart. He adapted his novel Stray Dogs into the screenplay for U-Turn, which was directed by Oliver Stone and starred Sean Penn. Like Stray Dogs, Ridley's new novel, Love is a Racket, is a humorous homage to film noir. It's about an ex-wannabe screenwriter who has resorted to making a living with small-time con games. As the novel opens, he's $15,000 in debt to a loan shark, and the loan shark is giving the kind of urgent reminder that loan sharks are famous for.
Crop was the sound that I heard. Heard it twice, crop, crop, one time each for my two fingers that got broke. I heard my bones pop before I felt anything. Gunshot loud, they echoed in my ears. Maybe that was tip-off that what had just happened was going to hurt like hell. Wrong. It hurt so bad I didn't feel a thing. The hands that held me, Ty's hands, big like bear claws, strong like presses, let me go. I twisted to the ground, slow, the way a snowman melts. Couldn't help from going down. Something about having body parts mangle that messes with your lucidity. I gave that a lot of thought as I lay on the hard, dirty pavement that felt featherbed comfy to my screwed-up senses. If I slept a million years in this outdoor bedroom, I couldn't care less. Sorry, Jeffy, Ty said from somewhere above me. He meant it, too. I could hear it in his voice. It almost made me feel guilty. It almost made me feel like, even though he just busted my fingers, somehow I was the bad guy. All Dumas had to add to things was, let's see if we can't get me my money. Do you know, Jeffy? I heard the two of them walk away. I heard them get in their bins and drive off. The sound seemed to drift from the other side of the planet. I was alone, on the ground, in an alley. I thought about getting up, but the growing throb in my swelling fingers told me otherwise. It said I should relax, take a rest, pass out for a while. Why not? I didn't have any plans, nowhere to go except a little further down in life than I already was, and there was plenty of time for that. I got cozy with the dirt and rubbish and remained undisturbed. People passed by the lip of the alley, but they paid me no mind. Just another black man stretched out near some garbage can. So what? So nothing. So life went on around me. I took my finger's advice and went to sleep. Later I came to. The same throbbing in my fingers that passed me out woke me up. Except sometime during my mini-coma, the dull pain had gone through a metamorphosis into full-on agony. Agony that instructed me in the strongest possible terms to get to a hospital. Hospital. That's what I thought. Free clinic is what I meant.
That's John Ridley reading from his new novel, Love is a Racket. The main character is a small-time con man who earlier in his life tried to be a screenwriter and gave up on that.
Yes.
Why did you want to make this con man a former would-be screenwriter?
Well, it's interesting. In the original drafts, he knew a lot about Hollywood, and he had a lot of angst against Hollywood, but he wasn't a screenwriter. And it wasn't until I sat down and worked with my editor that he really started said to me, you know, there's something else going on here, and you really, to find this character, you sort of need to flush it out. And as I was going through the story again, I really realized that this is a guy who'd been roughed up by Hollywood. He was stuck there and someone who had a really, really hard time and had an axe to grind. And, of course, someone who, myself, has sort of been through the Hollywood grind there, I started to realize that, in a way, this character was a lot more like me than I think I wanted to fess up in some of the early drafts. And that really is one of the great things about working with an editor and coming in, having someone come in with a fresh perspective and can help you find something that was in the story but wasn't really articulated as well as it could be.
What are some of the small-time cons that you've come up with for your character?
Well, this guy, he plays the short con, and the short con is usually just trying to cheat people out of their money, say, $5 or $10 at a time. You go into small mom-and-pop stores, and you try to do a fast con on them where you try to get change from them, but confuse them to the point where you get $5 or $10 back. It's not a lot of money. And actually, my sister used to work at a dry cleaner's, and somebody ran that con on her once. And you get maybe $5 or $10. You can't really con people for a lot of money when you do the short con. So you have to work constantly. You have to work all day long to make $50 or maybe $100 at best. And it's sort of an interesting life because you're not making a lot of money, but you sort of live for the con because you would rather do that than do anything else. And there are times in the story where people call Jeff D on that and say, look, for all the work you're doing, why don't you go out and get a job where you can make some real money? But the guy's a con man at heart. You also have we have card players, we have gamblers, and we have a lot of people are just sort of working at that low end of bringing any kind of money in. And to me, that's fascinating that people would rather be cons and card players than work for a living. To them, that's a better life, no matter that they might be getting their fingers broken.
Now, your characters live in, you know, the kind of low-rent part of Hollywood that you describe as stinking of desperation.
Yeah.
Have you lived in neighborhoods like that yourself?
I did. When I first came out here, I lived on Hollywood Boulevard in Hollywood. And when I first came out here, it almost sounded cool. You live on Hollywood Boulevard in Hollywood. But as life goes on, you realize it really is a desperate place, and it really is a place where people end up when nothing else works out for them. It's just people who want, you know, they want to be famous, or they want to be rich, or they want to just be artists, or they want a round of applause at the end of the day, but they want something, and they can't get it. It's a really awful place, especially when you realize that most people who don't really know Los Angeles or have never been out here, they talk about, yeah, I'd love to go and I'd love to see Hollywood. Or you see the tourist buses pull up in front of the Chinese theater. People take pictures, get on the bus, and get out of there as fast as they possibly can. To me, it's a very sad place. I think it's sad, and I have a line about this in the book, because the weather is so nice. You know, you have beautiful sunshine and palm trees, but there are people who just want to make it through the end of the day. It's, to me, heartbreaking.
Now, you grew up in Wisconsin, then moved
yes.
to New York, and then went to Los Angeles, hoping at first to be a stand-up comic.
Yes.
Yeah. What was your material like then?
It was, at that time when I first moved out here, it was moving into sort of, not really a political comedy, but it was more social comedy. It was more comments about things that were going on. I had a joke right about that time about, it was right after, right about when President Clinton was pushing for gays to be allowed in the military. And I said, you know, a lot of people are upset about that, and my line was something like, well, I think, you know, gays shouldn't have to go to the military. I don't think gays, blacks, or women should have to serve. It's just be, you know, middle-class white guys whose parents make more than $100,000 a year. I have no problem with that if they want to go to foreign countries and get shot at. So it wasn't strictly political, but it was more sort of that, you know, sort of taking what society is thinking and try to find, you know, the flip to it. You know, if they don't want gays in the military, great. If they don't want blacks in the military, that's fine. Things like that. And it was sort of, it's interesting. I think when you're, my feeling was when you're sort of a young black guy and you're being very articulate and sharp about politics, you don't really get as much play as if you were sort of like the Def Comedy Jam comedian that people, you know, it's laugh and it's funny, but it's sort of not quite threatening because that's what you think a black guy should be talking about. There's certainly, you get to the point where people don't look at you and say, hey, we're going to build a sitcom around this guy. So that's pretty much when I started writing.
So you went on to write for television sitcoms.
Writing for television, I was writing for The Martin Show and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and I wrote for The John Larroquette Show. And I'm actually writing again now in TV drama. I'm writing on a new drama that's going to be on this fall on NBC called Trinity. But when I was on The Fresh Prince is actually when I started writing Love is a Racket. And it was a very difficult show to write for. It was a very popular show, but at the same time, it was very narrow-focused in the type of writing you were doing. You know, it was usually, you know, a fat joke and a kind of a short joke and a dumb joke about the characters, and that was it. And it was very hard for me because on the one hand, I was making a good deal of money and I had respect in television, but I wasn't happy with what I was doing. And I used to lock myself in the office and start writing this novel, which was Love is a Racket. And at the time, I really thought it was probably never going to go anywhere. No one would ever see it, but it really made me feel good. I mean, it was my life preserver in a way.
Now, why did the noir style of storytelling appeal to you?
I think that goes way back. When I was younger, I was in maybe a freshman in high school. I started reading Chandler And I was younger than that the first time I saw a noir film, Double Indemnity. And it was just a really, it was so, to me, it was so rich. You know, when you're a kid and you watch Disney movies and you see these sort of happy movies, and they're all nice and they're what children should be watching. But one day you stumble on something that's black and white, and people, I remember the end scene in Double Indemnity when Fred McMurray is talking with Barbara Stanwyck, and she's going on about how she loves him. And he says, "I'm not buying it, baby." And then he shoots her. And it's just, you know, to me, it was like taking drugs for the first time. It just took you to a place that you had never been before, and I fell in love with that. And then when you read Chandler, and he's talking about Los Angeles, and I'd never been at the time, but this place that is just so dark and strange, and you know that he has this love-hate relationship with it, it's really powerful. It certainly was powerful for me, at least. And I thought it was just, instead of looking at the world and accepting everything that you see, noir is certainly cynical, and it was interesting to me that these people could not accept everything they see and can see it for being harsh and dark and hard, but at the same time find these little gems that to me meant a little bit more because they were gems in a very dark place. It's like digging up diamonds. The rocks around you are all dark and dirty, but there's that one thing that glitters, and it glitters a little more brightly because it does shine in the darkness.
My guest is John Ridley. His new novel is called Love is a Racket. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with comic, screenwriter, and novelist John Ridley. Now, you write a comic version of noir. For example, in Stray Dogs, your novel that was adapted into the movie U-Turn, it's really a comic twist on the loner who comes to a new town and is set up in some kind of blackmail or murder plot. In your novel, every step he takes, he meets another crazy, sinister character who's abusing him or setting him up. There's always a woman who's sitting down next to him, and next minute he's beaten up by her boyfriend who's just walked in the door and assuming right. that they're having an affair, which of course they're not.
That's right.
How did you come up with the premise for that?
Well, I think, you know, I certainly love noir, but I think if you just go in and you take sort of a straight-ahead approach, you're really sort of setting yourself up. I mean, people have done it and done it so well. How are you going to compete with Chandler or Thompson or Kane, people like this? You really can't. And for me, because I think I was a stand-up comedian, I had written sitcoms, and I had a funny bone. I didn't want it to be a straight out-and-out comedy, but I certainly wanted to have a lighter touch and sort of a dark comic touch. And also, I think with Stray Dogs, as a guy who, as a comedian, had been on the road and traveled to a lot of small towns and had a lot of sort of odd incidents, I definitely wanted to draw from a semi-real place. These are all much more hyperbolic than anything that ever happened to me. But that feeling, and I think we've all had that feeling, maybe in a small sense or a large sense, but you get trapped at an airport and you can't get out of it. There's a snowstorm and all the shops are closed and you just feel like the world is closing in on you. Or you're somewhere and your car breaks down and you just want to get out of that town. And I just wanted to take that feeling and put kind of a comic spin on it so that people could enjoy it without being beaten up every minute by a very morose tale. Noir, I think, is hard for a lot of people to take because it is tough and it is, you know, it's a downer. Everybody's down. And this story you can read and you can have a little bit of fun with it. I always say, you know, it's fun and it's funny, and then the bodies start adding up at the end.
There's a scene I want to play from U-Turn. And this is a scene where, you know, Sean Penn, the stranger in the small town, is just going from one mishap to another, from one, like, abusive stranger to another.
Right.
And now he's in a diner. And, of course, they don't have what he wants to order. And he's sitting down just kind of being astonished at how bad his luck is. Then Claire Danes comes over and sits down next to him and starts flirting with him.
Right.
Then her boyfriend, played by Joaquin Phoenix, walks in the door. Phoenix assumes that Sean Penn is trying to make it with his girlfriend, Claire Danes, and here's what happens.
No. Now, I'm seeing, but I'm not believing. No.
Mister, what do you think you're doing, my girl?
And here I asked you a question.
Toby, we wasn't doing nothing.
Shut
we
your
was
mouth,
just talking.
Girl. Get back over to our table.
Mister, don't make me ask you again. What do you think you're doing with my girl?
I wasn't doing anything.
Well, that's not the way it looked to me. It looked to me like you were trying to make time with her.
Make time with her? Is everybody in this town on drugs?
Honest, Toby, I just asked him for a quarter for the
girl, job. Shut your mouth. Look here, mister. You and me, we got a little man's business to take care of. And no, I ain't never taking no drugs.
Well, maybe you should. Now, look, I wasn't trying to make time with you, girl. Okay?
Mister, I'm calling you now.
You want to fight over her?
You know, I don't think you know who I am. The name's Toby N. Tucker. People around here call me TNT. You know why?
They're not very imaginative.
Because I'm just like Dynamite Boy, and when I go off, somebody gets hurt.
Fine. I was trying to make time with your girl, you're right. And now I'm terrified, and I've learned my lesson, and you can go away.
Jesus Christ. Stand up. Stand up, mister, or I'll beat you where you sit.
That's a funny scene. And I think I particularly like the part where Phoenix describes why people call him TNT, and Sean Penn points out what a cliche this is. And that's something that kind of comes up in your fiction, where somebody says something and the main character realizes this is a real cliche. And I figure that's what you're up against a lot as a writer. A lot of people say things to you, and you're thinking, "Boy, that's really a cliche."
You're right. I mean, I think there are those times when you're writing something, and I certainly don't go into it to write like, "Okay, I'm going to do this and claim it, and therefore get away with it." But there's so many times when you write something. For example, with Love Is a Racket, I got one review. Where they compared the entire book to The Grifters by Jim Thompson, because both the lead character in this story and the lead character in The Grifters play the short con. And out of everything that happens in both books, it boils down this comparison that they're both con people and therefore they dismissed Love as a Racket. So you're always up against people's perception of what you're doing and how you're playing things out. And there are a couple of times where I certainly am writing something and I'm thinking, okay, you know, no matter what I do with this, somebody's going to look at it and think this. So, you know what, let me think it for them and therefore mitigate what they're going to say. So it's, but I don't think you can spend your life second guessing your critics and things like that. But I think no matter what you do, if somebody is not going to like what you do, they're going to find a reason to not like it. So all you can do is go out and have a little bit of fun with it. It's interesting about that scene. I really love that scene in the book, and I also like the way it turned out in the movie. And it was that scene actually really happened to me once when I was
at
a club in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I was at a bar. I was hanging out, and this girl comes up to me and just starts putting on the full press. And, you know, you're a young guy, and you're alone at a bar in the middle of nowhere. You're just impressed as heck. And I mean, I was having a great time with her, and I left the bar. And the bartender had been serving me drinks that whole time that I was sitting there. He came out, and he's a nice guy, and I've been talking to him, too. He just came over to me and goes, "Oh, hey, by the way, that girl you were flirting with all night, that was my girlfriend." And she apparently went into bars and did that, went into this bar and did that a lot with guys in front of him just to piss this guy off. And I was very fortunate. He was a nice guy, and he was used to it and wasn't trying to beat the heck out of me. But that was something that really stuck with me, and that's the reason I put it in the book.
Well, I have one more question for you, and this is a test of your ethics.
Yeah.
You, you had to learn a lot of short cons in order to put them in your novel, because your character is a con man. Did you practice any of them to test them out before writing them?
I did not practice the short con. I will tell you something that I hope I cannot be prosecuted for. And there was something I used to do because I don't know why I did it really, but I used to, and this was when I was making really good money too. I used to go into we have big supermarkets out here. I don't want to say which one it was, but they're open 24 hours. And so you go in very, very late, and it's nobody's there, and people are stocking, and nobody's paying attention. I used to steal magazines. I would always steal one magazine out of the store just because I wanted to do it. I wanted to get away with it. I wanted that feeling of stealing something. I'll tell you the last time it happened. I was stealing a magazine out of the store, and I was standing in line. I had it tucked under my jacket. I was holding it there with one hand. Waiting for a checkout person because there was nobody there because it was so late. These two LAPD cops come up behind me and are standing in line. And so I'm standing there with this magazine that clearly I'm lifting. And at first I thought they were coming straight to bust me. Then they're standing there to buy something. And I'm waiting for a checkout person. And you have this incredibly long minute with these cops that are are there that could easily bust you. And it was great for me because I would certainly never commit a large crime, but I think it's very hard to write about these things if you don't have this moment where you feel what it's like to be hunted or wanted by the police. And it was a great experience, one, because it certainly got me over that desire to lift things for whatever reason, but two, just to be in that place where I put my characters and to be able to really experience that emotion. So I do have that. I do have that. So I fess up to it, and I'll probably be getting a knock on the door later in the day.
I'm making a few phone calls as soon as I'm done.
I know. Well, it was. I can say it was 7 years ago, so I can't be prosecuted for it. So it's an admission.
Where do you think this compulsion came from to steal magazines?
I think it's cheap to write about something that you don't have any you don't have any relation to, and to write about crime and to write about bad things. I don't ever want to go out and commit a real crime. I don't want to commit a felony. I don't want to go to jail.
So you think you were doing this as a writer?
I think I was doing it as a writer, but not necessarily as a writing exercise, but as someone who's into noir and into the dark side. And I had a friend who kept telling me, he said, man, one day you're going to get caught and no one's going to have any sympathy for you because you write for television and it's going to be the most embarrassing thing in the world. Television writer gets nabbed stealing a $2 magazine, you know. I mean, what do you say? It's not like, hey, I had to feed my family or I don't have a job or anything like that. But I had to know, I had to have that feeling of getting away with something. And it was, I think, perfect that the police showed up right behind me, and to have to sit there and sweat it out for a second. And again, I don't ever want to sweat out, you know, are the police going to catch me for killing somebody or robbing jewels? But to be able to transpose my feelings into my characters, it's, you know, you've got to make that leap just a little bit. But it's certainly much smaller now than just, okay, I'm sitting in my apartment or my house and I'm making it up. So it was a great experiment. It was a terrific experiment. I'm completely over it. I don't recommend it. And I'm not advocating a life of crime to anybody under any circumstances. But, you know, the old adage, you got to write about what you know. Well, now I know, so I can write about it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
John Ridley's new novel is called Love is a Racket. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Stanley Tucci, the director and star of Big Night, talks about his new film farce, The Impostors. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, reviews a CD of film music by Shostakovich, and Milo Miles reviews an expanded version of the garage rock anthology, Nuggets.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich is best known for his long, serious symphonies and moving chamber music. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has discovered that for nearly half a century, Shostakovich was also writing soundtrack music for Soviet films. Some of this music has been recorded, and Lloyd finds some fascinating relationships between the music for concerts and for films.
Of the major composers of this century, Shostakovich often strikes me as among the most problematical. His chamber and vocal music seem to me his best work. Devastatingly sad, or cheeky, needling, satiric, even sarcastic, avoiding the endless bombast and heavy-handed profundity that often compromise his symphonies. The biggest puzzle about Shostakovich is whether he was Stalin's official state composer, which is what we assumed in the West during the Cold War. But now it seems that his music was filled with secret jokes that ridiculed the Soviet dictator's policies and person. So Shostakovich has been rescued not only by political correctness, but also by the multiple layers of meaning his music provides to those in the know. And yet, however brilliant his orchestration, however ambitious his musical architecture, many of his important works are still a long drink of water. That's one reason I'm so taken with an album called Movie Madness, of excerpts from Shostakovich's film scores. Most of these selections are only 2 or 3 minutes long. The two longest are under 8 minutes. Shostakovich used or invented popular tunes in his symphonies. But in his movie music, his borrowings or imitations are even more delightfully tongue-in-cheek. The film Golden Mountain must be set in Vienna. Its waltz is an infectious and admiring takeoff on Strauss. I've never seen any of the films that Shostakovich scored. There's a Hamlet and a King Lear, one called The Gadfly, one called Trilogy About Maxime. A 1949 film called The Fall of Berlin is surely a post-war propaganda piece. The liberated Dresden scene from 5 Days, 5 Nights ends with Shostakovich's own more acidic orchestration of Beethoven's Ode to Joy. The piece called The Ball in the Castle from Hamlet hardly suggests the intrigues of a Danish court, but it's vintage Shostakovich. All of the selections on this Movie Madness CD are taken from discs that contain more complete soundtracks. Someday I hope to explore them, But right now, I'm happy listening to these rousing, sentimental, and comic miniatures, vividly played by the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra under Mikhail Yurovsky, James Judd, and Leonid Green. These selections are Shostakovich in his most charming and understated vein. I'm not in a hurry to see most of these movies. I actually like guessing what the story might be. In fact, that's just what I do in his longer works. I create my own scenario. And the very fact that Shostakovich wrote so much film music reassures me. How could all that musical visualization of screen images not have had a big influence on his concert music?
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Movie Madness, excerpts from the film music of Dmitri Shostakovich on the Capriccio label. Coming up, Stanley Tucci talks about his new film farce, The Imposters. This is Fresh Air. After a career of playing heavies, Stanley Tucci showed his versatility by co-writing, co-directing, and starring in Big Night. This film comedy, set in an Italian restaurant, became an art house hit. He's followed that up with a new film farce, which he wrote, directed, co-produced, and stars in. It's called The Imposters. When the film begins, Tucci and co-star Oliver Platt are two out-of-work actors who are completely broke. Through a series of comedic twists, they end up with free tickets to a play starring a famous hammy actor whose success they resent. After the play, they go to a bar where they mock the actor without realizing he's there. A brawl breaks out, a chase ensues, and they end up hiding in a crate on a dock. The next morning, they find they've been loaded onto a fancy cruise ship which is getting ready to leave port. They're discovered by the head stewardess, played by Lily Taylor.
Okay, who are you?
We're actors.
Actors?
Just actors.
Actors. Would I have seen you in anything?
Maybe.
Impossible. Possibly.
Were we actors?
No, not yet.
Jane? Put it in 13. Okay, right.
We're of the theater.
We're seeking a representation.
Okay. Why are you stowaways?
We're not. We hid in a crate last night.
Escaping from the police.
For something that we did to that man back there that was an accident.
Do it.
He's famous. He's a hack.
He's overrated.
Oh, you're the ones he was talking about.
Shh. Yeah, but we're innocent. We're I swear we didn't do anything.
We couldn't hurt a fly.
Accident.
He
overreacted.
He's a big
baby. We were at a bar.
We
drank too much.
Admittedly so.
But I just was expressing an opinion. It's a free country. And he attacked us physically.
He attacked us.
He attacked us.
He almost killed our friends.
Please, you have to help us get off this boat.
We'll do anything for you. Please help us get off this boat and take us home. Will you please take us home?
Okay.
But they don't get off the ship, and they're forced to use their acting skills to assume various false identities in order to save their lives. The cast on this loony cruise includes Campbell Scott, Isabella Rossellini, Steve Buscemi, and Alfred Molina. Tucci says he wrote the two leading roles with himself and Oliver Platt in mind.
Oliver and I did a play together about 10 years ago at the Yale Rep, and it was really where we got to know each other and became fast friends. And we used to do these improvisational, sort of ridiculous improvisational exercises before going on stage. And we created these two characters, or we came up with the idea of two unemployed actors who would do anything they could to act to maintain some sort of emotional stability. So that was the sort of seed of the thing.
This movie is a farce. Tell us what a farce actually is. I think it's a word we all throw around without knowing exactly what it means.
I know. I throw it around, too, and I really don't know what it means either, to tell you the truth. I mean, I've done it on stage and I've done it on film periodically, or things that are semi-farcical. This is, at times, a pure farce. I think for farce to exist, I think it's helpful to have an enclosed space. In this instance, we have a ship, and people cannot get off of this ship. There were no helicopters in those days, in the 30s, you know, the time it was set. That's helpful. I think it's good to have usually three people, at least three people, and lots of secrets.
I think of a farce, too, as being a story in which every action has an unintended reaction or consequence. And so it's just right. This kind of like whole chain reaction of unintended consequences that are very funny.
Right. Yes, that's either a farce or a tragedy. I'm not sure what.
That is true. That is true.
I mean, the thing is, I think they are so similar. If you look at the structure of farce and then you look at the structure of a tragedy, it really is very much the same thing. I wonder if you couldn't actually take a script and shoot it first as a drama and then take exactly the same script and shoot it as a comedy and never change a word.
Well, there'd be less people walking into each other in the tragedy.
Right, that's right. That's
less right. Doors opening at the wrong moment and
right,
so on.
Right, things like that.
When the movie opens, you and Oliver Platt are two out-of-work actors. Well, two actors who never had much work to begin with. Mm-hmm. And you can't get a job, but you can use your acting skills to impersonate other people. And you end up doing that aboard ship because you start off as stowaways in a situation
right.
that I won't even bother to go into because it's so complicated.
Well, it's so
and
complicated
so filled of surprises that I just
yeah.
assume not give away. Anyways, but in an incident, even before you get on the ship, you impersonate other people in the hopes of kind of conning somebody out of some food. I've always right. wondered if actors do that, if actors try to pretend that there's somebody else, if they use their acting skills to get anything they need, whether it's to giving an officer an excuse when he's trying to write you up a parking ticket or getting a favor from a stranger or, you know, whatever. Have you ever done that?
I think so, to a certain extent. I mean, certainly never to the extent that these poor fellas do it. But I think you do try to use those tools, maybe the tools of status that I learned actually that sort of laid out in this book called Impro by Keith Johnstone, and how you raise and lower your status. I mean, I think you use those tools to a certain extent. But you can only change who you are so much at the drop of a hat, I think.
Now, we talked about this once before, about these the rules of status that you
yeah,
use.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but I want you to just go over that a little bit again, because I have a couple of questions I want to ask you about that.
Well, it's based on there's two status. You have high status and you have low status. And a low status person is somebody who maybe talks very quickly and gestures quite a bit and averts their eyes from the person they're talking to. Maybe hangs their head low or something, shuffles along. That would be extreme low status. And high status is someone who's quite still, looks you straight in the eye, speaks very slowly and clearly and distinctly, and is unmoved, seemingly, by anything that you say. Those are the two sort of extremes of status. And characters exist anywhere in, you know, anywhere in between those two. It's a matter of finding, when you do a play or a film, what status your character is to at any given moment.
No,
and if well written, it should change appropriately.
What's interesting to me is that some of the characters that you first became famous for were the heavies uh-huh. who had so much power
yeah.
that they
yeah.
were high-status people. They didn't right. have to move a lot or,
right.
you know, a little eye gesture, you know, emotion right. could intimidate somebody. And
right.
in The Imposters, you're so kind of in the character, so like insecure and unsure of his place in the world that he's
right.
he's kind of slouched a lot of the time and motioning
right.
a lot of the time and
right.
obviously really unsure of himself.
Right. Yes. Yes. That was easy for me.
Well,
yeah.
it's funny. The more famous you get, now you're playing the lower status people. It's
right. I know.
It's often
but
the other way around.
I know. See, that's what happens, and I think that a lot of actors, they want to play high status characters because it's very sort of satisfying. You're in control and so on and so forth. And you see people who are movie stars, they always play high status characters.
Right.
It's really very boring, you know? And then you have the character actors, quote unquote, who play the lower status characters, you know, a lot of the time. And it's not as – or some movie stars make a career of playing low status characters, comic low status characters. It's much more interesting to me to be able to do all of it. I mean, that's what I was trained to do, and that's mm-hmm. what acting is all about. To have the opportunity to play a really low-status character is enormously satisfying, because especially someone who is playing someone who is an actor, because then he changes his status when he needs to change it. So it's very satisfying.
Stanley Tucci is my guest, and he wrote, directed, and produced the new movie, The Impostors. Now, Big Night, I think, was a pretty big success, certainly in the art house circuit. And I know it played in Philadelphia a long time and was very popular here,
yes.
Where I live. So one of the reasons, as I recall, that you made that movie in the first place was to write a role for yourself that was different than the role anybody else was going to give you, because they all thought of you as being the heavy, and you wanted to right. do a different kind of role. So right. Did that open up doors for you? Did it get people to perceive you in a different way?
Yes, it did. It did very much so. I was doing Murder One also at the same time that I was actually editing Big Night. So they were viewed by most people at about the same time, and both of those roles, for different reasons, I think opened people's eyes and put me in a different position, which was really nice. I mean, it's something that you hope will happen. That you don't just get offered the sort of heavy mafiosi anymore, that you will be taken seriously as somebody who can do a variety of things. And those roles seem to do that. I was very happy about that.
And did that make it easier for you to get backing for your new film, the success of Big Night?
No, in fact, not at all. I mean, people had no problem seeing me as a director after Big Night, but the difficulty was that this was a farce. And I wrote on the cover page, I wrote "A Farce" by Stanley Tucci. And it was a huge mistake. It was as though I had written, "The Plague" by Stanley Tucci. Nobody wanted to make this movie. They said, "Farce does not work on film. You can't do it. Nobody's done it in 40 years. Every farce somebody tries to make, it's a failure." And Lindsay Law at Fox Searchlight and Claudia Lewis were the only people in North America who really would make this film and let me make it the way I wanted to make it.
Let's examine this preconception. Farce does not work on film. Why would people think that?
I think because attempts at it, as of late, were relatively unsuccessful. For what reason, I don't really know. I think that I tried to assemble all the elements that I felt were important to make farce work, and mostly that being a script that was fairly tight, but also actors who were trained in the theater and who had an understanding of the genre. And because I have done it myself on stage, and I know when it fails and I know when it succeeds, I think that makes a big difference. Because I think of a lot of the films that were made earlier, farces, they were made by people who came from the theater. And I think that that affects how you make that film.
When you were writing this, did you have to have almost a map of what every action and reaction was going to be so that you can work your way from the beginning to the end?
Yes, in a way. I think that one of the key things to farce is that it must be very logical. And I think a lot of the times, perhaps the reasons that movies have failed, that have attempted to be farcical, is that they concentrate too much on the gags as opposed to the logic of getting to the gag. The gag has to come out of the situation, which has to come out of the character's need. So if that logic is in place and you stick to that basic tenet, it should work. Otherwise, if you try to impose a gag on a situation or on a character, it won't be funny. It'll be funny for a second, but it won't really add up to anything in the end.
Right.
That's the hard part of it.
When you have a lot of friends, as you did on this film, working in your own production, does it make you nervous in a way? Because, after all, you have to meet payroll to pay them. You have to, if the movie's bad, it will make all your friends look bad. You're directing them, and you have to kind of pay attention to their egos as well as to their performance. These are not perfect positions to be in with friends.
No, I know. It's why they're no longer my friends. No, I'm only kidding. No, it's yes, it was a very, when I started, I was very sort of relaxed. And there was a certain point during shooting when I thought, these people are so talented, they're so good, they've gone way beyond my expectations. I really have to make a film here that is worthy of them. And I got very nervous at one point. And then during the editing process, that feeling came back again, and it was very scary. I feel now that the film does work, and I have showed it to most of them, and they feel that the film works too. The hard part was cutting things out that they did that I really cherish. And what I hope to do is to work with these people again in a lot of different capacities and making a lot of different films in a lot of different genres. And then we can explore things that maybe we touched on in one film but weren't able to keep or complete, and then we can bring them into another film.
Is it hard to have to be the boss, so to speak, on a set with a lot of friends with whom you probably feel you're all equals, but this is a situation where you can't just be the equal, you have to be the leader.
I know, yeah. It was a little nerve-wracking. And there were times when I really just wanted to hang around with them. They were having such a good time that...
Had to interrupt, too.
I did. Right. I had to. One day I had to, like, yell at them and say, come on, guys, you know, we really have to. And they were all giggling and laughing so much. It was hard, and I felt bad breaking up their party. But, we had to finish the day. I had to shoot. At times it was hard, but it was worth it. I was just glad that they were there, and I appreciated very much that they were there because they really didn't make any money doing it. And they worked very hard. And it meant a great deal to me.
Well, I wish you really good luck with The Imposters.
Oh, thanks.
And I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Stanley Tucci wrote, directed, produced, and stars in the new film farce, The Imposters. He stars in an HBO movie about Walter Winchell that premieres November 21st. Coming up, an expanded version of the garage rock anthology, Nuggets. This is Fresh Air. Music thousands of American teenagers played after the end of Beatlemania until the rise of the San Francisco sound did not have a name when it was happening. It was all but forgotten soon after it happened. This music is now called garage rock, and a double LP collection called Nuggets brought it back from obscurity in 1972. Music critic Milo Miles reviews an expanded reissue of the Nuggets collection.
I feel depressed, I feel so bad. Cause you're the best girl that I've ever had. I can't get your love, I can't get affection. Oh, little girl, psychotic reaction. And it feels like this.
Most folks who have oozed into middle age can remember friends who immediately decided to form a rock band after encountering the Beatles for the first time. Or maybe they wanted to be the Rolling Stones, or Van Morrison's Them, or the Kinks. At any rate, they wanted some of that new rock star action, and an astonishing number of them went for it. A few got the 3 minutes of true fame with a breakthrough hit single. A bunch more failed to get the fame they deserved. You don't want to know about the rest. But rock and roll was changing with a momentum and pace hard to imagine today. By the end of the 1960s, what fans now call garage rock was tossed in the dustbin of the uncool. All the hip people just knew rock was going to become more symphonic or more intimate and confessional. It was not going to be like that loud, crude junk. Digging bands like the Shadows of Night or the Count Five was like sucking your thumb at a pot party. What do you want? But some true believers persisted. One of them was Lenny Kaye, a rock writer who went on to become Patti Smith's lead guitarist. His first awesome act, though, was to assemble the original Nuggets collection, 27 tracks on two LPs. The new Digital Era edition comes as four CDs with a whopping 118 tracks. Seems like overkill, but this is the goods, baby. By my accounting, the new Nuggets includes every great garage rock tune and most of the very good ones. Some are perfect bizarreness, broadcast from Mars.
There's a sudden rise in the mercury. There's a thumping in my heart, it just had to be. Heat wave, hurricane whirling in my head. Cool disposition just hanging by a thread. Is it a question of love? Is it a state of mind? No, 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 no.
It's a question of, it's a question of, it's a question of, it's a question of
temperature.
A lot of the time, the groups just sound like miniaturized versions of the British Invasion, or punky Bob Dylan imitators, or eager white boys who want to be soul machos. But then as now, this collection proves that rough vitality lasts, that a simple pleasure beats some ultra-hip convolution every time. The glib line is that the best garage rockers were good because they were rudimentary technicians, didn't know any better. I say they were good because they rode over their shortcomings with hard work, a dash of inspiration, a bit of luck, and a load of band chemistry. The new Nuggets is a diverse, quirky, shameless, raunchy, ridiculous, rampaging amusement that goes off like a string of firecrackers. It's a vision of 100 local bar band bums having a transcendent day.
Milo Miles is music features editor at Soundstone.com. He reviewed the Nuggets box on Rhino Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Alan Tu directed the show. Bob Purdick is our engineer. I'm Terry Gross. On the next Fresh Air, William Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts and former associate counsel for the House Judiciary Committee's Nixon impeachment hearing. Weld is a Republican who has often broken rank with his party. Now he's written a new political novel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.